All right, so today is September 27th, 2011. This is the first interview with Tim Frandy. We're here inside a research room or study room in Memorial Library on UW-Madison's campus. And my name is Troy Reeves, and I'm the head of the oral history program at UW-Madison. So Tim, thanks for agreeing to meet me today. The topic basically of this interview and the follow-up interview is going to be the protests that were held on the Capitol grounds and inside the Capitol in February and March of earlier this year. But since you are a graduate student, and we don't have a lot of oral histories with graduate students, I think I'm obliged to ask, we'll ask the first question, which is, why did you choose to attend graduate school?
Oh, I don't have the best answer for that. I did my undergrad in Stevens Point, and I was in English and math, and you know, I was always sort of just good at school. Some of my professors, you know, said, "Oh, you should consider graduate school," and so I did it. I always thought, I come from a family of educators too, so I always thought that teaching would be a good career path for me. Then I ended up at graduate school in Washington State for a couple of years, where I got an MA in English, and then I came back here. I developed a sort of interest in regional literature, in particular of like the Lake Superior region, and so I returned to Madison because I wanted to get back to Wisconsin, which is where my family lives, and I also wanted to learn the Finnish language because it was sort of emerged from my research interests in Washington. And so Madison's one of the few places that teaches Finnish.
Okay. I want to ask a couple of follow-up questions mm-hmm. on what you just said there. First off, you said you come from a family of educators. I'd like to, if you don't mind, if you'd talk a little bit about your mother and father, and also tied into that, where exactly you grew up.
Well, I grew up in a town called Arborvitae, which is just a few miles north of Minocqua. My dad's family, were very large extended families, you know, and my dad's family, most of them live in Manitowish Waters, which is about 25 miles north of Minocqua, right on Highway 51. And my mother's family is from Danbury, Wisconsin, which is in the northwest corner of the state, about an hour south of Superior, 2 hours north of Eau Claire. So all those places I sort of consider home, you know, in various senses. My father was a school teacher. He taught high school math. He's retired now. My mom's retired too. She taught for a couple years. She taught English in Chautauqua, but she didn't like teaching because she's kind of shy in front of people and large groups. It would make her nervous. So she ended up being a church secretary. I'm on my dad's side of the family. He taught, his two brothers taught, my grandmother, his mother, taught. On my mom's side of the family, several of my aunts and uncles teach, you know, various levels of school, but it's kind of just part of the, you know, part of the family, part of the annual life, having summers off and working hard during the semesters.
So it sounds like your DNA gave you no choice. You had to major in English and math in college.
It's you know, just drawn to certain things for whatever reason. It had really nothing to do with them, you know. I took classes. I haven't done math for years, but it was just easy for me, and it was a nice balance to all the reading. I started off as a music major, though, so you know. But that didn't go so well.
Where did you go to school in Washington?
At Washington State University. It's on the east side.
Pullman,
yeah, you know it.
So what drew you there?
To Washington State?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the reality, coming from Stevens Point, which is a small school, you know, you have fewer options when you're talking about grad schools. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm from a small town, you know, always did well in school, but, you know, I had no concept that, like, if you're going to do something like career academic, you know, a career in academia, then doing your undergraduate at a Research One institution is important. That didn't make it, I had no idea, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of limited my options. Like, I couldn't get into Minnesota, I couldn't get into Michigan for grad school. You know, and maybe it was my writing and stuff too, but I, you know, I think the degree from a smaller school was definitely not an asset. But that said, I think that the quality of education was phenomenal there, you know, working directly with professors and, what was your question? Why Washington? So
right.
My professors came out of Washington State mm-hmm. for their graduate work, so they had connections over there. And, you know, it's unfortunately lots of it, what goes on is who you know. So I went to Washington.
Well, as someone who grew up somewhat nearby in Idaho, I'm interested in your take on your 2 years mm-hmm. in Pullman. Both in terms of the sort of the academic, but then also the sort of the social aspects of living in Pullman as well.
Where are you from in Idaho?
I'm from southeast Idaho, so
okay.
I'm from a long ways down,
yeah.
But I had friends who went to University of Idaho, so
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Never was on campus, but I knew of
mm-hmm.
What we call Wazoo.
Yeah.
So anyway, if you wouldn't mind talking just a little bit about an overview about your time there.
Well, it was different, you know, it was it was a big stepping stone. When I was there anyways, the English department was sort of a hostile working environment. There was a lot of competitiveness, and there were some very aggressive people who would, you know, and I don't mean to target them, but there were, you know, there were largely this like aggressive Marxist MA students.
Mm.
It was like a clique of them, and they would go around and tell everyone that their research wasn't good enough, or your research is racist, or, you know, and it was really stressful. And it was being such a small town, the culture of the department was very insular, because few people who attended school there were actually from Washington. People came from all over the country. And then they're thrust into this environment in this very small farming and university town. And the only people you saw during the academic year were your department. People didn't have lives outside the department. So it was very tight-knit, very insular. And I developed strong relationships from there, but it was a little bit of an intense experience. And then, you know, with the infighting too, it was a really uncomfortable place to be working.
It's interesting. Not that I don't want to get too much of me on here, but
nice.
I mean, I grew up in rural Idaho,
mm-hmm.
but I did my graduate degree at Utah State, which is just across the border in Logan, Utah,
mm-hmm.
In a small town, a very small Mormon town,
mm-hmm.
and my 2 years in graduate school was very insular and very in a department that was very contentious, to say the least,
mm-hmm.
and so. You saying that sort of brings up some memories for me
yeah.
of what my 2 years in graduate school was like, too.
What was your degree in?
History.
Okay.
So I ended up hanging out a lot with history and then American studies and folklore
mm-hmm.
people
mm-hmm.
because we all came in from outside of, well, I didn't really, but the rest of them came in from, most of them came in from outside of Utah or outside of sort of this Mormon
mm-hmm.
Enclave. So.
Mm-hmm.
We really had no choice, we felt anyway, but to hang out with each other.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of congruency with the rest of the outside, either undergraduate or the community.
Yeah, yeah. Very very similar experiences, I think. Here it's been a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
You know, quite different.
Well, let's talk about that. So you mentioned briefly why you chose UW-Madison. And you talked a little bit about your research interests, but I wonder if you would delve into that a little bit more and perhaps start with what your research interests were when you came here, and then if that has changed over time, why?
Well, I think my research interests when I came here was largely because I'd been working with regional literature from the Lake Superior region, in particular the Upper Peninsula, and I was interested largely in the Finnish-American community, which, you know, like I said, caused me to want to learn Finnish. And this was all done about was in Washington from 2001 to 2003, so then I came here in the summer of 2003. And so for my master's thesis, I had written on this, and, you know, I'd read, started reading some Finnish folklore then, and I started, you know, reading some of the scholarship of Tom Dubois, who's my advisor now. And so, you know, I got a little bit interested, but it was largely like Finnish Americana stuff, immigrant studies, ethnic studies. I've always, since my undergrad years, I've been interested in ecological criticism, which has been sort of the basis of a large chunk of my research, like literary eco-criticism. And so then I came here and I started with those sorts of interests. But then, you know, as I started studying with Tom more, then my research interest, I mean, Tom's a really wonderful scholar and very broad-based. He publishes on all sorts of folklore from all over the world. You know, he's worked with, you know, I guess the big changes are that he's, you know, sort of instilled in me are an interest in Sami culture. Now, right now, I work more with Sami people than Finns or Finnish Americans. So that was a big change. He's also interested in religious studies. So I was working with worldview issues before, so they kind of overlap. But he's done fieldwork with shamans, for example, and looks at shamanism during periods of colonial transition in Arctic Scandinavia, in Arctic Russia or Soviet Union. And so I've taken a large interest in that sort of aspect too. So, you know, I've written on shamans and such. Let's see, I suppose the other thing I've been looking at, labor issues too, I suppose is relevant to the interview. Jim Leary, you probably know Jim.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's worked a lot with labor in the past. So it comes in part from him, and part probably more so just from the fact that I started getting involved with TAA shortly after I came here.
And I want to ask about that, but I do want to ask you to clarify or elaborate on a couple of things you mentioned.
Sure.
And the first is ecological criticism.
Yeah.
Would you explain, maybe give the Reader's Digest version of what ecological criticism is?
It's sort of a post-structuralist look at environmental themes in literature, in the literary sense. There's different ways to approach it, but, you know, I suppose in the sort of old-fashioned view, it's man versus nature, but, you know, the reality is that it's not an antagonistic relationship, and it looks at how, you know, green spaces, forests, waters, farms, land, the environment, you know, in its various forms, are constructed. You know, is it a place that's passed through? Is it a place that generates economy? Is it a place? Is it a common space? Is it shared? And if so, what sort of social rules, formal and informal, regulate the use of these environmental spaces? There's a lot of nuance and complexity to it, but you know.
Okay. The other thing is, you said you're now more interested in the Sami culture. Could you spell that and then explain what that is?
Yeah, Sami is S-A with a slash, M-I.
Okay.
Or the A is written with the accent line over
the
top.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
Yeah. And Sami people are they're also formerly called Lapps, L-A-P-P-S.
Okay.
But, become sort of a derogatory term now. They live in the northern parts of Scandinavia and in the Kola Peninsula of Russia, Norway, Sweden, Finland, Russia. They're indigenous people. They speak a Finno-Ugric language. It's related to Finnish. And they historically, they've been known for herding reindeer. They live in Guahti or Lavu, which are, they lived up until like the 1950s, 60s, They were living in basically tipis, which were lavu, or turf huts, which are the guahti. They lived a subsistence-based economy until fairly recent times. And now there are, sort of mixed economic realities where they'll do a lot of fishing and hunting and have some reindeer, but then they'll have a day job too. I work with them on various issues. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that, I'm guessing, means going there to be with them. Is that true?
I go over there and I do my field work and I do interviews and take photos and, try to learn things that I can, that can learn, serves as the basis for lots of my research.
When did you, or do you recall, you've been here since summer of 03, your involvement in the TAA, how did that come about?
I wasn't too involved my first, I got here in 2003. I was technically a special student, and then the spring of 2004 was the strike semester, and I was only marginally aware of the TAA at this point. I wasn't terribly involved. I wasn't involved at all, really, with that strike. But it certainly heightened the awareness. I walked a little bit on the picket lines. I don't even know if I'd signed a membership card at that point. I think it was the fall 2005 when I became more serious about it. At some point, I had signed a membership card, and the staff organizer, Rob Henn, contacted me and called me, and we met at a cafe. It was Steep and Brew on State Street, and I was all ready to get involved anyway. So then I started sitting on the Stewards Council that for a few years, and then got more seriously involved, I think, in 2007-2008 academic year. There was the CAPE campaign, too. I think that was during the fall of 2006. That's when I really started getting involved.
Could you elaborate on the CAPE campaign?
The CAPE was the Coalition for Affordable Public Education. It is a coalition group that was spread throughout campus, like Louise Robbins from Profs at that time, she was involved with it a little bit. The whole idea was there was a restructuring in the way that grant money was going to be, channeled off to the university if you're hiring a project assistant. Under the old system, I think it was a flat fee of about $4,000. If you're hiring a project assistant, they take $4,000, you have to budget in your grant $4,000 to go and pay for the tuition remission of this graduate student. John Wiley was involved with, he set up a task force to say that this is the problem, we're losing money at the university, and the task force was charged with finding various options as to how to go forward. And the option that they recommended against, but said that, but which Wiley liked, was to double the amount of that grant money that's used to fund the tuition remission. So instead of having to spend $4,000 of your grant money to pay for tuition remission, then everyone was spending about $8,000. And so and what ultimately resulted was a net loss of PA ships, and now PA ships are very hard to come by on campus, relatively hard. The CAPE was an organization that was, it was trying to oppose this change because it wasn't good for the research at the university. Professors didn't like it because they couldn't hire project assistants easily. Then that grant money started going to other universities. I don't know the numbers on it, but that was a theory anyway, that they're less competitive in writing grants. It's not good for the graduate students because there's less funding to go around. And we made the case that tuition remission isn't real money. You know, it's money that the university never collects anyway. So what does it matter if they're collecting $4,000 or $8,000 off a grant? You know, it's just skimming money off the top. But the university didn't like that argument very much because they're short on money. And there was some weird budgeting things because of the university is forced to budget in certain ways through the state statutes, that the university has to budget as if it has tuition money that's not actually there for graduate assistants. You know, just one of these crazy things. There's more details, but it's probably not terribly relevant to our conversation. Yeah. Anyway, that's sort of what CAPE was about. They're still around. There's all sorts of issues that I think they're working on. There was, graduate students can't get in-state tuition rates. We can live and work here for 10 years, but we're not qualified for in-state tuition rates if, so long as we're classified as students. So, you know, that's a big issue that should be fixed, but there's not a lot of incentive to fix it, obviously, because it means declined revenue for the university.
Mm-hmm. So in your situation, because you're born and raised here, are you considered a resident?
Yeah, I've always had residency.
Okay.
And there was something I found because I had to get residency in Washington, which was easy. But then I came back here, and I was worried about it, and they said, if you graduated from a Wisconsin high school, then you have residency for Wisconsin in terms of tuition. So that's never been an issue for me.
But as we talked about earlier, with folks going to graduate school, they usually are coming in from a different state to go to graduate school, so it is an issue for those folks who...
Yeah. I don't know the numbers. I would guess that about 2/3 of the students are out of state who are graduate students.
I would guess that's a fair guess. I don't know it either. But
I think it's 2/3 or 3/4. Or mm-hmm. And I mean, we're forced out of state for our graduate work. It's you know, career suicide if you go to the same school for all of your degrees. You know, it's mm-hmm. just not a good way to get a job.
Right.
Yeah.
So you talked a little bit about your involvement in the TAA. The next question is, and this is obviously getting us up to the events of earlier this year, were you involved in politics, or would you consider yourself to be involved in politics before February of 2011?
Oh, yeah. I mean, definitely.
Could you just maybe elaborate a little bit on your involvement in politics pre-2011?
Well, for me personally, the electoral side of things has always been my least favorite aspect, but, you know, following CAPE, you know, I got more and more involved with the TAA. I was the co-chair of the Stewards Council. Then in 2008, 2009, I was co-president of the TAA. The electoral stuff is important and interesting. It's never been my favorite side of union work. I prefer the organizing work that goes on.
Could you, you gave a really nice example of CAPE. Are there other things sort of after CAPE, and I'm sure there are, but are there things that stand out in your minds after the tuition remission issue and then February 2011 that you were interested in working on, either as part of the TAA or on your own?
Sure. Let's see. Well, some of the bigger things that went on during those couple of years, there was the big fight to get domestic partner benefits on campus. You know, it was this campaign that, like, the TAA was actually instrumental in launching in the 1990s, I think around 1990, were the first state union to be pushing for the fact that, you know, gay and lesbian people or unmarried people should be able to, you know, have family insurance plans or, you know, have, you know, hospital visitation rights and these sorts of things. And so we pushed for it hard. I think once we won it in the contract in 2000, and it was then the state assembly or senate, I'm not sure which one, we were denied our contract because it was controlled by Republicans who didn't want to give gays or lesbians these benefits. But at, in 2008, when we flipped the Assembly and Senate to Democratic control, we were able to get them in writing. And now, of course, they're under attack again. But so part of the work, the project in getting this done was we had, had a huge electoral program in 2008. You know, it was easy because of, you know, all the Obama energy. But we were able to do the same thing on a state level. And there were many close elections that year that were, for like state senate and assembly, that were decided by less, like 1,000 votes or less. And the and TAA people, you know, in conjunction with, you know, the AFT, Wisconsin, and, you know, the South Central Federation of Labor, which is the AFL-CIO regional center. They, I mean, there's a large campaign to get out the vote in, like, rural, because Madison's safe, right? So we were taking carloads of people out to the outlying districts, you know, 2-3 times a week over the weekends, and doing labor walks, which have, you know, walk lists of people who are members of the AFL-CIO, and we knock on the door and, like, give them literature and remind them to vote and tell them that we, you know, their union has endorsed these candidates. Anyway, so there was that. There was a large campaign around the natatorium referendum too, which was TAA led. And that, of course, there was an ASM election, right? They did this for the Memorial Union renovations under John Wiley. Under Wiley, they had 3 votes because he really wanted to use seg fee money to pay for part of Memorial Union renovations and a new union south. And they held a campus-wide election. And the vote failed. So there were so many votes cast. It was one of these online elections. There were so many votes cast that the system crashed. It was overwhelmingly no. And then he said, "Oh well, you know, this system didn't work. We know we can't trust these ballots. So we have to do it again." So a couple months later, they had the same election. Can we use seg fee money to you know, pay for these new buildings? And votes came in. No. So then he thought, oh, we'll try it a third time. So, you know, an ASM at that time was really controlled by sort of two very chancellor-friendly people. The chancellors will take undergrads and bring them to, like, the chancellor's mansion or whatever it's called and sort of wine and dine them, get on their good side, and then the students feel all self-important and are convinced that whatever the chancellor wants. I mean, they're used as tools. So the third time this ASM referendum came up, and they decided to only have it. They took out the electronic voting. They had to vote by ballot over the course of 2 or 3 days. There were only 2 locations, and at the same time, I mean, the voter turnout was less than 5, like maybe 3% of the student body, or 3 to 10%. It was really low voter turnout, and they had Memorial Union employees, like, out on the sidewalk saying "vote yes," which is actually kind of illegal, or illegal-ish, you know, on paid time, mm-hmm. And they purposefully didn't advertise this coming election very much. I mean, they were trying to get the result they wanted, and so it squeaked by, you know, and most of the students didn't know about it, and I think that jacked up seg fees about $250 a semester, at that time, it was maybe 2007 or something, maybe 2006, the TA wasn't very well prepared for it or organized. And so, you know, this thing kind of slid by and nobody was ready for it, and it wasn't good. When I was co-president, we met with Biddy Martin, and we brought this. The idea when Wiley was leaving out to build a new natatorium was already kind of on the radar. And, you know, we heard about this, and, you know, we sort of had the attitude, never again. We are never letting anything like this get by again. Could we totally drop the ball? All these students are being charged more money, you know, for a building project. They could have funded in other ways. So when I was co-president with Mark Sipanich in fall of 2008, we went and met with Biddy Martin, and you know, we sort of mentioned that we have a lot of members who are very concerned about building projects, and that we had heard that the natatorium was going to be funded in this way. And she said, that's terrible. That's terrible. I haven't heard of this. I don't know anything about this. And then, of course, about a year later, she's out pushing for more increases in seg fees so they can build a new natatorium. You know, of course, she's acted outraged that that segregated fee money could be used for building projects at the time. But obviously, when did they put that election through? That was, I was actually in Finland when the election happened. It was spring of 2010. February or March, I thought it was March of 2010. I was living in Finland at the time. So then they got this on the ASM ballot again to vote for fees in the natatorium. And the TA launched a large campaign, like vote no to, you know, increase seg fees campaign. And they held the election, and it failed miserably, the proposed amendment. So the building money was not there. It was like almost 2-1, I think. Over 60% voted against the increase in seg fees.
Since we're not sure who's going to listen to this in the future, could you elaborate a bit more specifically on seg fees, like what they are and
Segregated fees are fees that are charged to all UW students in addition to tuition dollars. In theory, they go to a number of important student causes, such as a free student bus pass, or university health services, and various student organization groups, all of whom deserve to be, you know, funded. The problem is that since tuition has been capped by the state, and this is the case in many states, tuition increases are capped by the Board of Regents, when universities can't raise revenue through tuition, and they're certainly getting less every year from the state of Wisconsin, then they've been raising segregated fees as a way to sort of have a backdoor tuition hike. And so fees now are being used more for, you know, there's a lot of unknowns, actually, but, you know, one small part is the building projects. And, you know, at other universities are used, they charge like $100 elevator fee. You know, I think that's at UIUC, University of Illinois, Champaign, Urbana. Or maybe it's in Chicago. I can't remember which one. But it's a national trend.
Thank you for that. So one more thing before we get into February 2011, and that's November of 2010. After you found out, and you could speak either as you know yourself as a student or as a member of the TAA, you found out that not only did a Republican win the gubernatorial election, but also both houses became Republican. Both houses flipped, really. They were both democratically controlled. Did you have any thoughts of what may occur once they actually started to take office in January of 2011?
Well, to be honest, I didn't see the sort of radical changes coming. In part, you know, I'd been living in Finland from January 2010 until the late October 2010. So I had planned it so I would come back at the end of October, I had a little, I had a conference I had to go to, and then I wanted to be sure I could vote. So, the national health care bill, the Tea Party explosion of the town hall meetings, all this was strange and distant. I mean, I was half a world away, you know, living in the Arctic. And I would read the news and I thought, oh, it can't be that bad. It can't be that bad. And then, then when Republicans were elected, in 2010, I think I was just a little bit, I thought, well, they're not going to do anything, you know, they're gonna play it safe. Why would they make waves? I was definitely wrong about that one. The turning point was when all the state unions negotiated contracts were rejected. You know, Walker was upping his tough talk on unions, and you know, I really thought, you know, he started doing this after he was elected, and he started making you know, threatening statements like to the state assembly and the state legislature, right? And he started saying things like, he was acting like he ran the state from November on. Mm. There were like 2 months there, you know, he was running the state, and I thought, wow, that's really arrogant to think that he, before he's in office, he has any power whatsoever. I watched online when the state contracts were rejected one by one. I heard only a few hours in advance that this was going to be bad, and you know, then Russ Decker, Democrat, started voting no on them, which is just, just terrible. You know, the rumors, of course, were that he got a nice little buyout, you know, for voting the contracts down, but we can never really substantiate things like that. They know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. There's no rational reason. He didn't get along with Doyle very well, apparently. But a state contract being voted down, you know, that almost never happens. You know, the system's set up that that's a catastrophic situation. You know, the bargaining team, the OSER, who does the bargaining, is supposed to be empowered to make these decisions on behalf of the legislature, and then to vote down, that's really bad. So then things started escalating. We had a emergency membership meeting. I think this was in late November, early December, the TAA membership meeting, and a couple hundred people showed up. The room was just packed, standing room only. And we came up with sort of an emergency response team, you know, to try to strategize and be prepared for direct action. I think I actually made the motion to create like an ad hoc subcommittee of people looking for direct action. And some people in the room didn't like that I used the phrase direct action, and they wanted to rename the committee. It was just one of these long, sprawling meetings, but I just, you know, we recognized at that point that it was bad.
So, I didn't print off my chronology. I should have my chronology, but I believe an email came out from Governor Walker, might have been February 11th, about the budget repair bill and basically the voiding of current contracts. Mm-hmm. Do you recall when or where you were when you found out about this, and what was your immediate reaction?
Well, I was tipped off. Ron Blasco put it on his blog the Monday before the 14th. 14th was a Monday, so this would have been the 7th. On Monday, Blasco put on his, do you know Ron Blasco?
Writes
for the Isthmus, the conservative writer. He said, oh, something big's coming. And he didn't say what it was. He said, something huge is going to happen. And then, you know, we talked to everybody we knew. You know, we talked to AFT Wisconsin, who talked to the lobbyist Scott Spector, who would have talked to his Democratic friends in the State House. Everyone just said, you know, everyone, all the big wigs that we heard from, basically said, oh, he's just blowing smoke. Nobody's heard anything. What is Ron Blaska know? He likes to fan the flames. And then it got towards Wednesday of that week, and these rumors weren't going away. Then on Thursday night, we were starting to get pretty concerned. I think on Thursday sometime, we got a sneak peek in the TAA office. I was working there with the TAA staff, Rob Henn, Claiborne Hill, Peter Rickman, who's an activist and former co-president, Alex Hanno, one of the co-presidents. He was out of the country then. He was in Egypt. His family's from Egypt, and he was there. He was in Cairo, you know. Hmm. He went over to help with after the protests started in Cairo. He went over for a few weeks. I think Kevin Gibbons was there. But anyway, we were like four or five of us in a room in the office, and we got a call that sort of, you know, heard a rumor, through the grapevine that there's, you know, this incredibly destructive union bill coming out, that this is real, that what Blaska posted. We started getting ready. It was really, you know, you have, you know, four or five people sitting around like, oh my God, what are we gonna do? That's when we started working on it, I guess. I drove north for one day, but then I was only there one night, so I missed a little. I think because things were released on Friday. When I was driving north, I started seeing everything exploding. I saw the letter from the governor, so that I drove north on a Friday and I came back on Saturday early. And the whole time I was in the car, I was calling everyone in my cell phone, like, oh my God, you need to get ready. You know, I don't know what's happening. You know, everything's falling apart. It was quite a bit of chaos. That was the early time. But then through the weekend, I hadn't thought about that Thursday when we first found out, you know, the rumor. I hadn't thought about that for a long time. But yeah, we were working in the office. It got to be midnight, 2 a.m. And, you know, we had already planned this rally for Monday, this Valentine's Day rally, because we were anticipating huge budget cuts to UW. That was in the works since late January. We're all tired, you know, stressed, anxious, a little fearful. And we said, well, what do we do now? You know, it's late. And Peter Rickman said, you know, I think we should just go home right now. We said, we're going to need to get sleep, because we've got many, many long days ahead of us. And he was definitely right about that one.
There's something I want to ask that I think ran concurrent to this, and it may have been, and that's the... I mean, it only happened earlier this year. It's amazing that I can't think about it more clearly, but the idea of the new Badger partnership.
Oh, yeah.
I'm wondering if that was on the TAA's radar, or your radar, as this was going on, and what you knew about it and what your initial thoughts were about that, too.
Well, Biddy Martin proposed the new Badger partnership, and I was still in Finland, so it must have been September or October of 2010. TAA was talking about it. All fall, then I think in January or late December, we were trying to sort through the details, but I mean, Biddy was being really evasive, you know. I mean, the fact is she was just lying to us, and she was lying to everyone about it. You know, this plan, I mean, she would say, this plan, we've been talking about these things for years, and then it's no surprise. This shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone that, you know, that we've been talking about these things for years. And then we say, well, what are your ideas? She'd say, well, we haven't really talked about it yet. In meantime, she did meeting after meeting after meeting where, you know, she, you know, would try to show how, you know, open this process has been. And then when we would press her for any hard details on what this NBP stuff is, she would say, well, it's all still being developed. This is just sort of a new idea. And so a bunch of the campus unions and probably some faculty organizations too, were able to get like a seat at the table to actually discuss this. And they drafted a document in December, I think, called the Principles for the New Badger Partnership, which they gave to Biddy. Because after we started pushing on her, it's like, well, why haven't you invited us? You know, we have something called shared governance of this university, and we need to be a part of these discussions. And nobody knew anything. And so we drafted these things, which were never really honored. You know, the NBP, we were concerned about, you know, one, we wanted hard details, and we wanted to be part of the process. And, you know, not just in an advisory role either. You know, an advisory role means that you guys can form an opinion on this, and then, you know, I'll do whatever I want. We also had concerns, like, about the potential for union busting. For example, you know, at the Institutes for Discovery, they said, well, their argument that the campus made, it was that they didn't need to hire union food service workers because it's not a campus building, because campus only paid part of the expense, and it's funded privately, this operation, so we cannot hire non-union workers. I mean, ethically, you know, unions find problems with that, and it's not a good precedent to set, you know. So anyway, that was another one of our concerns, and we're concerned about tuition hikes. Yeah, because it uncapped tuition rates, and we said, well, you know, the Board of Regents fixes tuition for good reason, and, you know, we don't want unprecedented tuition hikes. Undergraduates lots of us have funding and tuition remission, but for undergraduates too, the cost has gone so dramatically high in the last few years that, I mean, it's not affordable at all anymore. I think it's disgusting, really. Public education isn't open anymore, you know. So, which is, I mean, different from even 15 years ago when I went through. So much more affordable. So those were our concerns anyway. And then when it found out that she was, you know, basically in collusion with the governor, that didn't go over very well. And she had sworn members of the university committee to secrecy, you know, like loyalty oaths. That wasn't good either. So then there was this big backlash against it. Ultimately, I think that she never had the discussion that she needed to have, and she didn't give it time. She wanted to force it through quick because she was convinced it was the right thing for the university, but, you know, that's not how the University of Wisconsin runs historically. It's about open exchange of ideas and talking things through and, you know, building consensus, you know, with faculty and students and, you know. So, TAA voted to oppose the NBP, and I think for good reason too, for lots of those concerns.
I want to ask one more thing, and then I'm going to wrap it up for today, because I think we're at a point where we can start on Thursday with the Valentine's Day event and sort of roll it from there.
Yeah. I've got a lot of information.
Yeah. My question is, since we've talked a lot about Chancellor Martin, I'm going to assume, one should never assume, but I'm going to assume you know a little bit about her background as a graduate student here and as a member of the second TAA strike in 1980. So I'm wondering, either as a TAA in general or maybe you in particular, did you find her attitude towards the TAA different than what you thought it was going to be?
Yeah, it was. I mean, to be honest, I've met her, and she's a very nice person, and I like her personally, but I do think that I was disappointed. You know, I had, you know, optimistically and naively probably assumed that, you know, she would be slightly more union friendly than she was. One thing we did, you know, in the budget bill in 2008, a handful of us were able to win collective bargaining rights for research assistants, and immediately she was, you know, Team Biddy was on the defensive. They put up websites, sort of, you know, anti-unionization websites for RAs as a resource center, and, you know, these sorts of things. You know, ultimately it probably would. You know, we weren't ready to organize RAs. There's 3,000 RAs on campus. We spent months and were able to get a list together, you know, and nonetheless find the, like, you know, what sort of rhetoric works. But she was right on the ball. Like, oh, research assistants have it so good. There's no need for unions, you know. It'll be interesting to see if that's still around on the WISC pages. I mean, she wasn't, I mean, I wasn't around during the natatorium thing, but, you know, I think maybe a little bit of bad blood formed there. We became a little bit of a thorn in her side, I think, because we wanted, you know, more transparency in what she wanted to do, and that wasn't really how she operated, you know. She sort of, she was really good in, like, one-on-one situations with people and convincing individuals, but she had some process issues. Ultimately I was a little disappointed, I guess, because I sort of thought I'd have an activist chancellor. You know, TAA pushed, I don't know if we formally endorsed her as the candidate to hire or not when they were doing the chancellor search a couple of years back, but, you know, I mean, I sort of thought we'd have a chancellor who would, you know, make bold statements and say, you know what, we are underfunded, what we do is important, you know, what we do generates revenue for the state, you know, every dollar of state money creates $21 and, in increased revenue for the state of Wisconsin when this money's put into the UW system. And she did some of that, but she wasn't aggressive enough, I don't think. And, you know, and I was so disappointed. I mean, during the rallies, Jesse Jackson was standing outside of Bascom Hall and giving a speech. It was on April 4th, you know, when the Martin Luther King Day. And, you know, the day of his assassination, Jesse Jackson came and he spoke to UW people. You know, and it was kind of last minute. It was a smallish crowd, maybe 100 people. But, you know, you have, you know, a great civil rights leader standing outside her office. Where is she? You know, that's not the sort of, you know, university leadership that I personally would like to have.
I always try to leave the narrator with the last word. So is there anything on your mind? And it can be something sort of post, something that went on in February and March that you're sort of, might be sort of percolating and you want to get it off your chest in case we don't get it. It might be something, you know, what happened before. Basically, is there anything on your mind that you want to get on the record before we close up shop for the day?
No, we're going to have more than an hour of stuff for Thursday.
Which is all right, which is probably good that we're meeting at 2:30. Just as long as I get back before 4-ish, we should be fine.
No, it all just kind of blends together. I think I'm good.
Okay. All right. Well, this concludes the first interview with Tim Frandy. Tim, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.